The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Come try new Skyline Dip Cholitos at your neighborhood Skyline today. A warm, soft tortilla filled with their amazing chili and cheese with an extra layer of cream cheese and crunchy Fritos corn chips. At participating Skyline restaurants for a limited time.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
It's one thing to be accused of one of the most brutal mass killings in recent memory. It's another to possibly sabotage your own defense from the inside out, maybe even with the help of mom. Today, we are diving into the psychological and behavioral puzzle that is Brian Koberger, from refusing to give his lawyers an alibi to possibly letting his mother's loyalty override legal logic. The case is turning into a masterclass in self-defeating behavior, or something even more complex. Joining us, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. The guy who's, written many books on these sort of topics, on behavior, how to decode human behavior and motives. Robin, from a behavioral analyst standpoint, when you see a defendant refusing to cooperate with their own defense team, at least that's maybe the assumption off the record. It's no officially thing that there's no official reports that he is, but under the influence maybe of a loved one, as we've heard from the reporting of Howard Blum. What does that signal to you? Is it defiance, denial, or something deeper rooted in their personality than their pathology?
You know, I think when it comes to Koberger, from what we've seen, what we've been studying about him for quite a while now, it's just he has this mindset of he's not wrong. He's done the research. He's done all the background. If it is him, he did all the planning. So he can't be wrong. Matter of fact, I still think that's why he didn't really have an accurate, if it's him, innocent until proven guilty, that he didn't have plan B or C because he did not anticipate plan A going wrong. I just think he's dug in on who he is and how to do things.
And it's interesting because what Howard is reporting, he's wrote that book, When the Night Comes Calling. A great reporter, very in-depth. So when he's saying something out loud, you pay attention because he's not one that's out to get clicks. He's saying it because it means something. And his reporting is essentially saying that Koberger's mom is continuing to encourage him to go down the path of where he's been going, not guilty, despite how maybe the walls are closing in. He is reporting and I think suspecting that, maybe Ann Taylor has at some point gone to Koberger and said, this isn't looking good. We may need to figure out our strategy here, and it may be more so saving your life than it is getting a not guilty verdict. Again, all speculation, and it's based on the reporting of Howard. mom's sitting there and saying, she doesn't believe he's guilty. I get it. If you're a parent, it'd be very hard to wrap your mind around that. Yep. It doesn't make her a bad person or anything. But if she really believes her son is innocent, of course she's going to be pushing him to keep fighting for not guilty. How do you think that would affect somebody like a Koberger? He's still going down the not guilty path, but do you think it's something he's contemplating behind the scenes, or with the support of mom, does it make it something that he wouldn't consider?
I don't know the influence of his parents in his life with his decision-making process. That's what the unknown here is. Her behavior makes complete sense. I actually looked up the stats on this.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious about this. And it's around 30 to 60% of parents of juvenile offenders, and he's obviously older than a juvenile, but he's in that bracket potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So 30 to 60% of parents offenders show denial or minimization of their kids' involvement in delinquent acts. And it's just on delinquent acts, not even in murderous acts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a high number. And then even from the 2019 Journal of Family Psychology found that roughly 40% of parents with juvenile detention downplayed or rejected a child's responsibility for that. So it's not incongruent with what parents, especially if your son's being potentially put on death row,
mm-hmm.
Would do. But again, it goes back towards, I'm always thinking of what's he seeing, like with Ann Taylor, because remember, if he's not taking input and data from her or mm-hmm. shifting his mindset, what's the likelihood he's going to take it from his parents as well?
Yeah.
That don't know, don't you just get the sense? I mean, I get the sense that he's probably sharing more of what actually happened with Ann Taylor than he probably would be with mother and dad. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I mean, he can only share so much with Ann, too. He can't be like, I killed him, and now we need to find a story for this. I mean,
and I also remember we said this before, too, talking about not, being resistant to her, giving her an alibi or something. I don't think he had one planned.
No.
He wasn't planning on failure.
Is that surprising, though? I mean, if you're this... he thinks he's so smart about this. Even if you are, even if you know you're smart at something and you know you can put together the pieces of this and execute it pretty well, why wouldn't you at the very least have some sort of backup plan or something in case the police come calling or you get questioned?
I'm not basing on mine off of thinking he didn't. From what we're seeing, from what we know from the evidence we have and how thorough he was, mm-hmm. I mean, I've never seen a case that was so thorough.
Yeah.
With everything he had done, with the exception of the touch DNA on the knife sheath. Mm-hmm. I mean, he makes one very, very small boo-boo. Now, granted, he left the knife sheath behind, that's the boo-boo.
Yeah.
But just the touch DNA. Again, no blood splatter, mm-hmm. nothing in the vehicle, nothing anywhere. But there's zero evidence that he actually did something with the foresight of possibly getting caught. In other words, mm-hmm. he did not like the simple thing of going out at night, that whole stargazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
If that was actually a planned alibi, he should have been doing that more than just one night. He should have been able to draw on data from, hey, for the last 6 months, here's something I got into. Here's a hobby I have. In other words,
mm-hmm.
he didn't plan on an alibi. He doesn't have friends or contacts much, so he couldn't really use that. So he's going to have to use events, times, and places as an alibi, and he didn't plan for it. So
yeah.
When you don't plan for something, in my mind, it says that you were not planning on failing.
He also didn't plan for some obvious things, like the cell phone data showing where he's at, and driving around the house on a lot of occasions. Is that just inexperience?
Yes.
That okay? Yeah,
I still think it's he studied well
mm-hmm.
for a high. As I've said before, he studied well for a high school final exam mm-hmm. in how to commit a serial murder killing.
Based on data that I think was outdated.
Yes, the problem is he's actually taken an exam at the PhD level.
Yeah.
His professors were PhDs in this because they actually had life reps and maturity and experience and wisdom from academic side as mm-hmm. well as experience side. And so they were examining him as a PhD candidate, not as a high schooler.
Mm-hmm.
That's my analogy I keep going in my head. So he thought he was going to ace his high school test on how to commit a murder.
Mm-hmm.
Problem was his instructors, had PhDs.
Yeah. I just from the report that he did, I read through it the other day on the camera. I mean, it was boring as hell, but I mean, it's not supposed to be exciting, but it felt outdated as well. Like to some of the methodology in there was like, I mean, this seems like this, you know, would have been applicable in the 90s or early 2000s. It didn't really touch on newer technology or things to consider or what to, you know, exactly that, what to consider when investigating or if you're planning the crime. There was a lot of pieces that were not in there. So it seems like he would have done really good at this had it been 10 years earlier or 15 years earlier. But there wasn't a lot of consideration for, I guess, more current ways that crimes can be solved.
You know, it'd be really interesting in the case if it comes out, and also its absence of it will also be indicative, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he's known to be a PhD student. It would really be interesting if we find out what actually he studied, what cases he studied, because if what you would expect to see from someone who's trying to pull off the perfect crime, I want to see podcasts he listens to on true crime like ours or anything. Yeah. Or like, what are current cases that are like, was he following Delphi? Was he following Alec Murdoch case?
Mm-hmm.
Was he following, you know, Lori Daybell Vallow and those nutters? I mean, so, you know, there's a lot of cases, not just those ones that we cover, but there's a lot of cases that are within the last year of him doing this that I would have covered, that I would have been focusing on, is to look at how law enforcement does what they do, and even the Rex Uhrman case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, from the differences between when he started, you know, in the Long Island murders to where law enforcement investigations are now, what has changed over a period of time? I haven't seen any data, and maybe we'll see an investigation, I mean, in the prosecution and the case, about what he studied in the original cases to what's different now in investigative strategies, tools, techniques, and forensics.
One thing or one person that we know he did study, and there are some similarities, BTK,
yep.
He studied under Catherine Ramsland.
Yep.
Who, you know, wrote the big book on BTK, had all those interviews with him. She's been on the show, but she can't talk about Koberger. So there was some of that. I mean, there was, and if you look at...
How old is BTK?
The case? Well, I mean, he was arrested about 15, 20 years ago, roughly. But there's always been kind of ongoing things with the case. Like last year, we were talking early on about somebody went to the Park City house and they dug it up. Like, the house is gone, but they dug up where his shed was. And that sheriff in Oklahoma claims he found, you know,
bras or something. Right?
Or like panties. And then he's playing with them on camera with Ashley on, it's on News Nation. It's like, what are you doing? So they're always, it was still kind of lingering out there. It still is kind of lingering out there. But what BTK did was he screwed with the public and he screwed with the police for a long period of time by putting ads out there in the newspaper, the Wichita Eagle. And that's eventually what got him caught. He was so stupid. He said, "Can you track me from a floppy disk?" And of course they said no. But yes, of course you can see where that disk came from if you look at the metadata. So then that's how he ended up getting busted. Koberger, I mean, if that Papa Roger is him, which I would be shocked to death if it is not, considering just how similar he looks to that character and that screenshot, that image and the inside knowledge that he has, I don't know how that could not possibly be him. So that would be a lot of evidence kind of mimicking BTK in a sort of way. And it just kind of depends what else you look at here. That image, the headshot that he took in the bathroom, that also has a lot of weird tentacles to it that seem to point at others that maybe he looked up to, that maybe he had some sort of affinity to. I don't know if it really means a lot other than it shows.
And look up, you know, and look up to is an interesting word phrase you just used too. So when you're dealing with, again, let's again conjecture hat.
Yeah.
No psychological testing, we know, but when you're dealing with psychopathy and this type of thing, it's not that they look up to anyone. It's not how the brain works for them. It's more of a, what can I outdo them on?
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't idolize anyone, because they see themselves as the best. They see themselves as the most grandiose, that has the greatest skill set. So they're going to take the behaviors of people that have been successful and incorporate them and see if they can improve upon them. So, you know, it's interesting, because we tend to put too much humanization behind the inhuman. With true psychopaths, because there is no humanity in there whatsoever. It's devoid of it. They're empty shell predators. And so there's no idolization. There's mimicry. There's learning. I mean, it's like, just think of a mother shark training a baby shark on how to kill something. Just watch and do better. That's it.
Sure. Is it possible that he believes he didn't do it? I mean, let's assume he did do it. Obviously innocent until proven guilty, but let's assume it is him. After repeating this to himself so many times, he has his family behind him, you know, saying, believing he's not guilty, or assume at least mom does. Not a lot of other people, but he is starting to get some of that support online and through, you know, the pro-burger movement. Does that, or could that, in fill in some blanks, essentially override all logic, essentially override the actual memories of what he did, I guess, depending on the state that he was in, almost like a, you know, a blackout moment because of the intense adrenaline that must have been running through, I think, his blood and veins in that moment of time.
So I want to make sure I also give a shout out to the true expert psychiatrists that actually deal with guys like this, because I'm not at their level, like a Reed Malloy and a Chris Mahandy, which I absolutely adore and love. But I would, because I could be way off from what they would say, but I can't imagine where he would believe he didn't do it, because part of his fantasy is the fact that he did do it. Because remember this, so if someone does this type of thing as a serial killer in the making, or the first thing, is because they're fantasizing to get an emotional response and a rush to this act. And in order to continue to get, remember, he's self-described as not having an emotional effect. He's got that visual snow. So he knows he has these things, and there's been an escalation throughout his life of doing things, doing drugs, doing meth, doing all these things to get some sort of response. And so when he finally reaches the point where he gets enough of a response from murdering someone and takes a selfie of it afterwards, to deny himself that memory, I don't think he'd want to do that, because literally that's the only thing he'd be clinging to that made him feel good. So again, I'm not the expert on the really deep nuancing of this, but I personally have a hard time, from what I do know and understand of him, of thinking, because now it's different. This type of individual is very different than a Karen Reed, you know, or any of the other cases we cover, because those people actually do have humanity in them. They're not pure psychopathic. But if he is truly a psychopathic, then they're going to want to hold on to that.
Yeah.
I mean, so just imagine this. So we'll do a little thought experiment.
Yeah.
You think BTK would ever deny to himself that I didn't do it?
No, he was proud of it.
Yeah. See that? See what I mean? So let's just take who he's emulating and think of, right, so if he's thinking I want to be like him, or I'm going to model my behaviors off of that because that seemed to work for him, would he deny that he did these things, or try to rationalize it away that, you know, convince himself he didn't do it? No.
It's an interesting leap that is made with characters like this, where you try to find motive, and at the end of the day, the motive is just simply he wanted to feel it. He wanted to feel, period.
Yeah.
And to go from, I'm really into crime stuff, I'm really into these stories, and I get some sort of a thrill out of this that I don't get in other portions of life, to feeling those sort of things on the topic, but then to go, if I want the ultimate thrill, I got to go kill myself. I mean, that's so, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It certainly does. But that is such a bizarre and a what a drop off point for someone to go, yeah, we're here. And then all of a sudden we're going to do that. Like, what? Like, this is quite an extreme step. It's almost as if the idea of repercussions is gone. And the thought is just, I need to get that hit. I need to get that thrill. I mean, almost like a drug addict, do almost anything to get their high.
I was thinking exactly the same kind of analogy, not to the gross extent of this, but
yeah.
People don't wake up in the morning and say, all right, I'm going to decide to become a drug addict or an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Slow progression.
Yeah.
And same thing here. I mean, this is a lifelong progression. It took him to this age to do this act because it was a progression into, well, let me try this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hurt. It's not solving the pain. Let me try this. Or in his case, you know, people do drugs and alcohol and things like that to medicate pain in their mm-hmm. lives from all these other issues that are going on, something separately different. So they're doing a medication, self-medicating in unhealthy ways, and it keeps escalating because it's not solving the problem. It's not even the satisfaction they're lacking because they're not fixing the root core problem.
Yeah.
In this case, he's going for an emotional response to something. He's looking for emotional stimulus, and he tries one thing. Didn't work. Let me try to escalate a little bit. Not work. And so now he starts studying criminology, starts studying these types of cases, and they start to probably feel a little bit of a glimmer. Oh, that kind of gave me a little bit of rise. Let me dive a little bit deeper. Let me study this a little bit longer. Let me look at this case. And so as you keep escalating, that just like in a hit from drug or alcohol, you get normalized to it and no longer gives the same rush. And so in order to get that rush, you got to escalate a little bit more. I got to go a little bit more. And so you eventually get to the point where you murder someone and then it's like, huh, that worked out pretty good. But in order to keep getting that hit, I either have to visualize or fantasize it. So I actually have to stage people. I have to take trophies. I have to take selfies. And then I have to be able to do it again. And so even in BTK, you know, was it BTK that I was able to stave off for a number of years and put it in abeyance while he did other things that were able to.
No, supplement. He disappeared. He disappeared for like yeah. 2 decades.
And see, he was able to then do other things that he knew he needed that kind of rush, but he always had to be able to come back to there. So he had his trophies. He had his things he was doing. So this is an escalation.
I mean, that's a good example of someone who seemingly got their thrill and then like, okay, I got away with this and somehow knew maybe I should stop because the odds aren't going to be in my favor all the time. But then eventually felt like I need this thrill again. The memories aren't as sharp as they used to be. And then went out there and did it again. Who knows, had Koberger been able to get away with this, would he have struck again? Probably. You know, how long would it have gone on? And if he got away with it forever, would he just have that memory box, if you will, of that stuff and then stopping? I mean, look at the Golden State Killer. Those crimes took place a long time ago. And he just lived his life as a normal person for decades before getting caught. He kind of got his thrills and then lived his life.
I'll put in my thought experiment hat on. We are, again, if he's found guilty, we are so fortunate and lucky that mm-hmm. he was caught.
Yeah.
Because he, with the exception of touch DNA, he did a phenomenal job. And he would have learned a lot from it, and he would have gotten better at it. Yeah. And because now he wasn't able to do things that typical serial killers do that we've seen, like staging and, mm-hmm. and things like that. So his trophy box was pretty empty after this one, except for one photo,
mm-hmm.
if that is what it is. And so in my mind, I'm thinking he was going to do this again pretty soon afterwards because he needed that rush again, and he had nothing to draw upon from this one because the bodies are gone. They weren't buried someplace he could visit them. See what I mean? I mean, all yeah. the other things that you typically see on those serial killers and why they do them were kind of absent for him on that one because he kind of screwed it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there are so many unsolved crimes out there, unsolved murders like this, worse than this, less than this, all of it, where people have died. And something brutal really went on. Somebody did something horrible and that person has never been caught. Yeah. How often do you think it is in society where somebody pulls off one of these and they're done and then they just live their life and never get caught? And that's why we have so many unsolved cases, because they never exhibit the behavior again.
I wish I had the numbers. I actually looked at these numbers about a year ago.
I don't know how you'd even define that.
It's actually, if you do the, you know, hey Siri, what are the number of unsolved serial murder cases? There's a lot.
Oh yeah.
There's a tremendous amount. And that's why, these things are always, you know, people always, and you feel the tragedy here always is the victims' families that are left not knowing, because there's so many of them. And the only ones that get the deeper dive and a double look at things is there's some sort of personal connection to the investigation, the investigators and the families, or there's media attention, something like that, that takes place that gets that attention. Because I know this from my own experience in the FBI.
Yeah.
You have a stack this high that never goes away and only grows, and you can only cover this much every day of your life. And so you, as an investigator, you got to prioritize every day. And generally the things I got prioritized are the things I was getting yelled at for, the things I was personally feeling an emotional connection to. And I felt bad, tremendously bad over the things I couldn't do, but I only have so much bandwidth and they only hire so many people. And so that's why so many things get left behind sometimes. And it's sad and tragic.
Sure.
But that's the way the reality works of it.
Yeah. That's very true. It always makes you wonder. Like I always say, I always like the idea of at Christmas time, if everybody's together, go get the DNA kit from Ancestry or 23andMe or whatever, and give one to all of your loved ones. See who like rejects it. See who's kind of sitting in the corner, like, oh, I don't know about this.
Now, what they will do now, here's a glass half full.
Yeah,
you know, when you're sifting through that pile.
Yeah.
Stuff that you're going to do. You're trying to go with the ones that are going to have potentially the greater impact, that they're, you know, to avoid multiple killings. You're going to do ones that are going to be multiple sexual predators. You know, so you're going to go after the ones that have, if you take down this one, you take down hundreds, you know, of potential victims, and you save a lot of people. So that's how you basically prioritize. You're prioritizing over volume of people you can potentially save.
Who has the most tentacles, basically?
Yeah, because they go everywhere on some of these ones.
Before a single opening statement in a courtroom, everyone is already pulling harder on the steering wheel than ever, either the prosecution or the defense. In the case against Brian Koberger, the judge isn't just keeping order, he's directing traffic. Whole swaths of evidence are getting clipped out. Words like murder, psychopath, and even the term touch DNA are being treated like they're radioactive. Meanwhile, evidence like the K-bar knife and the order from Amazon and DNA on the sheath are left at the scene. It's all in. Game on. It begs the question, what's more important in a trial like this, the evidence itself or the legal scaffolding that tells the jury what to even pay attention to? Joining us is someone who knows the rules, has enforced them, and has even worked with evidence that can make or break a federal case. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, host of the Break the Case podcast. She's here. Let's not, you know, tiptoe at this. When you see a judge toss out words like psychopath and clamp down on forensic lingo while allowing the heavily curated Amazon history in, what's your first instinct here? Is this all on track? Is the judge doing a good job thus far into the case? Or is he boxing things in a bit too much? Where do you stand?
I think that Judge Hippler is doing a great job. I don't think you should be able to say psychopath, and there was another word. He's actually allowing
sociopath,
murder and murder.
Yeah.
You should be. It's a murder trial.
Yes.
But he got rid of the, you know, psychopath, sociopath. Those are out. And I think, in my opinion, the biggest mistake so far succinctly regarding the trial has been made by Ann Taylor. And that was to ask for touch DNA, trace DNA, contact DNA. Those three words cannot be said by any DNA expert on their side or the other side. And because guess what, Tony? Now they get to use the word DNA. And that is so much stronger than touch, trace, or contact. So in my opinion, she did not foresee what that meant, asking that. And so now they get to say DNA. DNA was there. DNA was there. And the jury is going to hear that much stronger than trace DNA. That's my opinion.
That to me is like a shocking error, if that's what that was on her part. Was she thinking that, okay, if we get rid of touch, trace, and contact DNA, that the whole word DNA is just not going to be allowed in. And she just failed to like mention DNA in general, because that to me is, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I look at that and go, yeah, those sound a lot more confusing and a lot less powerful than just DNA.
No, I agree. I think what happened is obviously they're going to be able to discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be able to say it wasn't from hair, blood, or semen.
Yeah.
They're going to say it's, but they can't say, like I said, contact, touch, or trace.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to be able to explain it, but still the jury is going to hear probably hundreds of times DNA, DNA, DNA. Mm-hmm. And I think she made a big mistake. I wouldn't have touched that with a 10-foot pole. It's in her expert's report. It's in the prosecution's expert's report because it's a specific kind of DNA.
Yeah.
Just like blood. Blood is not DNA. DNA is in blood and in hair and in semen, right? So to be able to describe where the DNA was located is critical, and she took that component out.
It makes me wonder a little bit because she's a pretty competent attorney. I mean, she's arguing like every possible thing she could possibly argue in this case, even if it's somewhat ridiculous. But I'm wondering how much Koberger is doing an influence on this, where I wonder how much of an idea that was his, saying, I want that out. That should not be in there because it's going to make people think this. And because his thinking is a bit skewed and not necessarily in line with the rest of the world, if that's, you know, one of his ideas and she's doing, you know, what the client is asking.
I see him and I don't know, but I see that his role would probably be more of like a research assistant, that she has him pouring through everything, looking for little nuggets. Certainly, I think he's very involved in his defense, but Ann Taylor is a very strong personality. She's a strong advocate. I think she's done a good job from the standpoint of that strength. I think the fact that she just throws everything up against the wall, Tony, I think it tends to diminish those important items she goes for. In other words, when you start just seeing everything being challenged, it just loses, I think, the punch that it would have had if she just would have focused on the more important details.
The fact that she is going after literally everything, what does that tell you about the integrity of their case?
They have no case. They're throwing up prayers. They don't have the facts working for them, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a case that you just are at a huge factual deficit, what are you going to do other than just send Hail Mary after Hail Mary and hopefully, you know, somebody catches it? But it's rough for them. And now the eyebrows are in, too. And that is another biggie.
Yeah.
You know, they tried to get Dylan Mortensen's testimony about the bushy eyebrows out because now they have that picture 10:30 in the morning right after the, you know, the crimes were committed of those huge bushy eyebrows. And, you know, we all commented the first time we saw him in court. Geez, they are manicuring those now. I should say when we saw him in court with a suit on, his hair gelled and looking good, him all manicured, and those eyebrows went from big caterpillars to little ones.
Yeah, that photo, that selfie, maybe one of his biggest regrets, I would think, maybe at this point in time. And in the far cry that he's innocent, even more so if that would be the case, because it does not look good in any way, shape or form. Let's talk about the K-Bar knife a little bit. Obviously, he purchased that well before the crimes actually took place. It arrived to his parents' home out in Pennsylvania, and then obviously would have traveled back with him to Idaho and to Washington. We got that. Obviously, it doesn't look good that you bought the exact type of weapon and sheath and sharpener that was used to commit a crime. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's the exact one. People do buy these things all the time. But it's not so much the purchase that is going to be strong here. It's the click history, because it's not just, okay, I bought this. It's, what are you looking at? How often are you looking at it? How damning is that going to be now that we know his history of looking at it before the crime, but also after the crime?
Right. That's the big thing. A couple of things there. So first of all, you know, the defense is trying to say, listen, anybody could have bought that and had it shipped to them at their household. But the problem is it's going to, I think, from what I've seen from the documents, they're going to have the credit card information and they're going to have the click history on his computer that matches up mm-hmm. with the order. So there's going to be no doubt it's him, number one. Number two, you're exactly right. After the murders, he was looking for a replacement K-bar. Mm-hmm. Like most of us, not most of us, many of us have been saying from day one, if he committed this crime, our belief is this was just the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, this is somebody who truly was capable of being a serial killer and mentally. And then the fact that he bought it early, again, back to what many of us have said, and that is he planned this, dreamed about it, thought about it, and, you know, in his mind, played it out so many times. So I'm not surprised at all. It was well in advance.
Way back, because like but 9 months is as far back as we know about purchases go between the mask where you could see his eyebrows and the K-bar knife and such. Do you think all that way back he had his targets in mind, or was it more of a fantasy at that moment and he knew he was going to eventually hone in on someone to execute this sick fantasy of his, allegedly?
I think B, mm-hmm. you know, your latter explanation, he had an idea of what they would look like. He had an idea of what they would be like, act like, you know, the person that they could never get, never be with, the person that represented mm-hmm. all he wasn't. And once he put his eyes on that and made his target, he was ready.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the cell tower data. Obviously, they say they have their guy that's going to say that, well, this shows he was nowhere near the crime scene based on his interpretation of cell tower data. But the problem is between 2:54 a.m. and 4:48 a.m., his phone wasn't on. So no one has that data. All we have is where it came back on, where he was going initially, where he left, or where he picked up from, which showed he was leaving the general area. How are they going to argue that? How are they going to go and say, okay, this geo data that you have somehow supersedes the experts that we have that are showing us? No, I mean, look, he's been kind of surveilling the house. It goes dark. He could have gone anywhere at that point in time. And when it picks back up, it shows he's leaving the general area. That just, I mean, it does not seem like a strong argument at all, but they don't really seem to have a whole lot of arguments to go with here.
Well, the two big pieces that really came forward very recently, one of them very recently, was that phone was physically turned off.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, initially, the defense was sort of saying, oh, you know, it's they don't have cell phone towers out there, blah, blah, blah. It just lost signal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we know, at least according to the latest documents, no, it was physically turned off and turned back on. That, to me, the jury is just going to eat that up, Tony. I think jurors are so smart. I really do. Maybe I've just had such great, you know, luck with every jury trial that I've been involved with. I mean, they see it.
Mm-hmm.
They really do most of the time. You can't pull the wool over their eyes. Mm-hmm. And they're going to see that. Oh, my gosh, you turned it off right before the crimes were committed and then turned it back on right after?
Yeah.
I think it's really, really compelling. But as far as what do you do when you have one expert saying this and the other expert saying that? Well, I will say in a lot of trials, when you talk to the jurors afterwards, the experts for them just negate one another and it kind of becomes white noise in the background. Considering all the money that is paid for these experts, you know, lawyers might not want to hear that. But if you don't have one to counter the other, then it looks like you're just capitulating the argument. So you have to have it.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience, typically the jurors are like, yeah, this one's paid by the defense. This one's hired by the prosecution. They negate each other. They're both going to say what they were paid to do. All right, let's move on to the facts.
And people can connect the dots. AT&T timing advanced records. That's a new phrase that's been introduced into this. The timing advanced records, it's another level of cell tower data that the defense is saying was hid from them, that the prosecution never turned it over. It's something they keep arguing in court. We didn't get this. The prosecution says, we didn't ever have it. So how are we going to give it to you? AT&T even saying, yeah, we didn't give it to you because we didn't have it. It only lasts for 7 days. And by the time you requested your data, it was many weeks later. And we don't keep that data that long. How long are they going to argue that? I mean, is that just a pretrial argument? Is that something that they can end up bringing up in court and try and say, look, this evidence was hidden from us? And who knows what that says, because we didn't get it. But at the end of the day, well, it existed for 7 days, but no one knew to look at it.
No, I think that could be brought up, particularly when they have the AT&T person that produced the records on. I don't think they're going to stipulate. Oftentimes you just stipulate. I think that the defense could ask for them to come on and talk about how we didn't get, it wasn't mentioned in the subpoena. And that was just a mistake, an oversight by the, in this case, the FBI agent, likely, that was tutoring the Moscow individuals. Remember, those people were sorely underexperienced. I think 2 years in, Payne had around 2 years, never done a murder investigation that I recall. In any event, he has said, you know, his mentor was an FBI agent. So whoever designed those subpoenas, and I remember toiling over all my subpoenas, especially when it involved technical data. Going through them, do I have everything? And then sending it to my cyber folks, to my digital cell experts on the cyber squad. Tell me, am I missing anything? Because you don't want to leave out just what happened there, a term that you're not aware of. And they're all over the place, depending on who you're subpoenaing, right? You know, you can't know everything.
Sure.
As an agent. So you go to the experts. So obviously one of these terms was missed. So I think that the jury could look at that, as long as they don't think it was intentional. I don't think it was a big problem. And then they'll get their expert to explain how that information does not, somehow erase the information it has. It just would have enhanced.
It's almost like the defense, if they bring it up, they're going to try and pitch it. It's basically adding confusion by omission. We don't have this. So what does it mean that we don't have this? Well, nobody has it. I think it could have been a boon to the prosecution, honestly, more than anything, if they had it, because it would likely put him where he was, or allegedly was. But if there's confusion and we just don't know, then that adds the element of, well, he could have been anywhere. Well, in theory, but everything else points to that he was there. The autism argument, the judge who says that autism can't be used as an aggravating factor in this. The state can only bring it up if the defense does it first. How do you think that's going to play? Do you think that the defense is going to try and bring autism into this? And is that going to be seen by a jury as part of a motive or mitigation in this? People can take that either way, I think. And one may look at it and going, oh, well, that means you maybe are a little more prone to do this if he's on the spectrum area where there's lack of empathy and remorse, which is what he's flat out said he feels. And allegedly, if those writings of his online are true and truly his, or it can be looked at in the exact opposite way. How do you think that will play? And is it something that would be wise for the defense to even throw out there?
First of all, this is one of those examples where I think Ann Taylor just was really reaching beyond what she needed to do. And this is why I say that I don't think the prosecution is going to want to bring up his autism. First of all, when I hear somebody is on the spectrum, to me, I have a brother. I absolutely look at it even more empathetically, right? Oh, you know, they might have challenges socially, but then anybody who's educated about autism knows that autistic people are no different than, somebody without autism in terms of being more murderous and more inclined to kill somebody or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think the prosecution had any intention of bringing up autism. I don't even know if the prosecution believes he's autistic.
Sure.
Just because one doctor has recently come out. I think the defense will use it. And remember, the judge didn't fully rule on this. I could see the defense using it to mitigate down the road if he's convicted, to try and mitigate a possible death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So I see them, why they, you know, brought up this new finding. I truly don't understand why they thought the prosecution was going to use it. I just don't see prosecution going in that direction. And now they won't be going in that direction because the judge says no.
Do you think we're going to see anything more psychologically about him? Are we going to, I mean, can the defense, you know, of him order some sort of psych eval? Can the prosecution order some sort of psych eval? Would either side want to order some sort of psych eval on him? Or the cards they're playing with right now, is it just a good idea to stick with what you have and hope for the best and not try to add something else into this mix?
Oh, I think those evals, in fact, we know now because of some motions we've seen that those have been done, and that the judge, he allowed it to come out that all of that was out there.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we're going to get to see the evaluations, but rather that they were done and are out there. And the prosecution, I think, if they could use all the information about how he spoke in his writings about the visual snow and lack of empathy, how horribly he treated his father, just all that information to show he was just a ticking time bomb,
mm-hmm,
of a person, I think it could really help the prosecution. But I don't know if it'll come in unless the defense really opens that door to try to blame mental issues for his actions. This is, to me, going to be one of the most interesting parts of this trial. I think the prosecution initially will just want to focus on the facts and not muddle it down with that. But, you know, juries want to understand motives. Why is this PhD student wanting to murder when he hasn't done anything except for some, stole a cell phone and had a few motor, mm-hmm, vehicle violations?
Yeah. You know? And that's what I'm wondering about. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, if more so not during the actual trial itself, but more so in the sentencing phase, if he's found guilty, if the defense will try to look back to those blog posts where he talks about visual snow, because I think that might give the jury a little more empathy, you know, honestly, towards him, going, they can say, look, he's been suffering from feeling this way for all of his life or most of his adult life. And, you know, this is someone who's not well, and, you know, spare him that. He couldn't control that part of his life, but lock him away, but let's not kill him because basically, you know, he's an injured duck on the side of the road. Do you think that they'd try and bring it up there? Because if you do that too, you can also probably bring up Papa Rogers if they can prove that, or anything else that digitally connects him. And more, most importantly, the damn photo with the eyebrows the next day with a thumbs up, because that right there, I think, is what could get him shot by a firing squad.
Yeah, no, I love all your points. If I'm the defense, I'm going to do just what you said. Mm-hmm. I am really going to try to paint him as somebody who didn't have a chance from since he was a young teen. He was 130 pounds overweight. He had a heroin addiction. He, mm-hmm, you know, struggled to be accepted, had visual snow, blah, blah. That is what and I don't mean the blah, blah, you know,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
Say. But all that prosecution has to point out to me, I would put up five pictures. I would put up a picture of Maddie, Haley, Dana, and Ethan slaughtered, because that's what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would put that picture of the thumbs up.
Yeah.
And I'd say, for these victims, you have to do, you know, he didn't care about any childhood trauma they had.
No.
You know, Xana's mother was a drug addict. Xana was abandoned by her mother. Mm-hmm. You know, Maddie yeah. had some, you know, home issues, blah, blah, blah. No, that does not excuse this. That's what I would say if I was the prosecutor. And I can't imagine. I just think a lot of jurors might. That picture might do it.
I do, too. I think when I saw that, if it's him, that is the nail in the coffin. So here's where things just got a whole lot more real in the Brian Koberger case. On April 24th, the defense, they swung big. They tried to take the death penalty off the table. Their argument? That Koberger, recently diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, ASD, level 1, to be exact. We have info. We have the receipts that he has the diagnosis recently. Should be categorically ineligible for capital punishment. No, according to the Koberger camp. Just like we shouldn't hear witnesses or evidence in the case, you know, things that make sense. They leaned into that diagnosis like it was their legal escape hatch, citing precedent, psychology, and tried to place ASD on the same shelf as intellectual disability under Atkins versus Virginia, which blocks the execution of individuals with significant cognitive impairments. The problem is, that's not what ASD is. Sorry. You kind of, you know, you're categorizing it into an arena that it ain't. It's like saying, okay, you know what? It's a nice day. We're excited for this. It's a football game. And then you bring a bunch of baseball players out to the field. It's like, well, this is a football game. Like, I know, we know that. But we thought maybe you'd like this. It's not how that works. And the court did not bite. Not only did the judge reject the motion, he laid out exactly why this wasn't going to fly, not just in this case, but likely not in any Idaho courtroom moving forward. Koberger's autism, the court ruled, doesn't qualify him for the kind of protection Atkins provides. Why? Because autism spectrum disorder, even at its most challenging levels, is not the same thing as an intellectual disability under the law. They're both neurological conditions, sure, but legally and clinically, they live in two different zip codes. Now, we have a lot to go through in this video today and this audio. So I want to hear your thoughts in the comments on YouTube. Please leave them there. Would love to hear them. If you're listening to us on any podcast platform, be sure to check out our YouTube channel. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you'll find us there in video form in Technicolor. You're like, what's Technicolor? Is that? No, it's how they used to say color television. You drive by like an old crappy motel that's probably filled with a lot of sex workers and meth and all sorts of fun things, bed bugs, things you don't want. They sometimes have a sign that still says Technicolor TVs. You know you're at a classy place then. So leave me your comments in the comment section on YouTube, and be sure to press subscribe right now, wherever you're listening or watching us, so you don't miss any of our coverage. The defense's case leaned heavily on reports from Dr. Rachel Orr, a clinical neuropsychologist who evaluated Koberger and confirmed the diagnosis. She noted a lot of what you'd expect from level 1 ASD profile, some rigid thinking, awkward social interactions, flat affect. The kind of quirks that might make someone come across as off to the average person. But none of those traits, none, touch the threshold for impaired intellectual functioning. In fact, Koberger tested with a full IQ scale on that scale of 119. That puts him well above average. Doesn't make him intellectually disabled. Makes him fully aware of what he's doing and probably able to do a lot of things better than most. Not just he's doing fine territory, but he could help your kids in calculus territory. This is a guy who has a bachelor's, a master's, and was in the middle of a PhD program when he was arrested. His GPA in that master's program, a perfect 4.0. And according to another expert report from forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Eileen Ryan, Koberger showed no signs of formal thought disorder, no language impairment, no confusion about the trial, the charges, or the possible outcomes. In fact, Dr. Ryan said he fully understood the proceedings and the roles of everyone in that courtroom. Of course he does. So not only is he mentally competent, he's likely one of the most academically accomplished defendants to face capital murder in recent memory. Now, none of that is to say Koberger's not neurodivergent. The court didn't dispute the diagnosis of autism, but it did make clear that a diagnosis alone, especially one that lacks any intellectual or developmental impairment, doesn't automatically open the door to constitutional exemption. Of course not. And when the defense tried to argue that the autism somehow made Koberger less culpable, less able to function, and more at risk of being wrongfully sentenced to death, the court's response was essentially, "You're reaching." And here's where it gets even tougher for the defense. They tried to pivot with a second argument, one that didn't hinge on national precedent or medical definitions. They claimed that the intense media coverage surrounding Koberger's autism had created an environment so saturated with bias that a fair sentencing was impossible. In other words, they argued that the media had turned Koberger's neurodivergence into a sideshow, highlighting his so-called robotic demeanor, his lack of facial affect, his cold stare. All the classic tropes the public tends to associate with the creepy loner archetype, which he is. And according to the defense, all of that coverage would make it impossible for a jury to consider his autism as a legitimate mitigating factor in sentencing. The public, they argued, has already decided that those traits weren't a sign of mental difference. They were a sign of guilt. I don't think so. I don't think anybody looks at it as a sign of guilt. But look, everybody knows those sorts of creepy people out there. Sometimes you end up hearing about them later in the news, like, oh, they did that. Yeah, I'm not surprised about that one. Because guess what? There's a lot of undiagnosed people out there. And Brian finally seems to have gotten diagnosed. They kind of operate out of some of the same playbooks. And no way am I saying everyone with autism is out there killing people. But yeah, that can affect your social skills, how you relate to others, empathy, all of that. It just depends where you are on the spectrum, because one person on the spectrum can be super empathetic and the other can have like little to none. That's why it's called a spectrum. But again, the court was not having it. The judge said in so many words that while media scrutiny might be unfortunate, it wasn't a constitutional issue. There's no legal precedent that says media coverage of mental conditions is grounds for striking the death penalty. And more importantly, that's what voir dire is for. That's why you question jurors. That's why you screen them. The court noted that if a potential juror can't separate media impressions from evidence, they can be removed. If they get selected and later show bias, there are mechanisms to address that. But you can't scrap the state's ability to pursue a death sentence just because Twitter's been loud and the Dateline specials haven't been subtle. And the court made one more point, kind of a quietly devastating one for the defense. The idea that Koberger's autism would prevent him from assisting in his own defense. That was flat out rejected. The court noted that not only is he capable of understanding the process, he's been actively involved in reviewing evidence, speaking with attorneys, and shaping his defense strategy. This wasn't a passive participant. This was a guy fully engaged in his own legal battle. And to make matters worse for the defense, the court pointed out that autism spectrum disorder is just that, a spectrum. And that means its symptoms, implications, impacts, everything. They vary wildly from person to person. There's no uniform experience for autism. You can't lump everyone under the same umbrella and say that they all face the same legal vulnerabilities. That variability is exactly why the law doesn't treat ASD the same way it treats intellectual disabilities. There's no IQ test that confirms it. No singular benchmark. It's too broad, too individualized. And that makes it a tough sell when you're arguing for categorical exemption from the harshest punishment in the justice system. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves the death penalty very much still on the table. The court's message was crystal clear. Koberger's diagnosis of ASD doesn't disqualify him from capital punishment. And the court isn't going to start carving out new legal categories unless and until the Supreme Court tells them to. This wasn't just a rejection. It was a line in the sand. Autism alone, at least in Idaho, is not going to be your get-out-of-lethal-injection card. Or firing squad. And let's not forget the symbolic weight of the ruling. This wasn't some minor pre-trial motion about filling deadlines or scheduling disputes. This was a major constitutional question. This was the defense swinging for the fences, trying to chip away at the prosecution's most powerful tool, the threat of execution. And it didn't just fail. It failed definitively. What this does beyond just shaping the future of Koberger's case is reinforce a pretty stark message. Neurodivergence, unless it severely impairs intellect or functioning, is not going to offer protection in capital cases. And for the defense, that means the road ahead just got a whole lot narrower. Because if you can't eliminate the death penalty, your best shot is undermining the evidence. That brings us to what the court had to say about expert witnesses, forensic analysis, and exactly who gets to tell the story of that night in court. That's what we're about to get into right now. It's one thing to fight the charges. It's another to fight the evidence itself. And in the Brian Koberger case, the defense has made it plenty clear that they'd prefer a smaller trial. One with fewer experts, fewer charts, fewer explanations of things like tower triangulation or digital forensics. The fewer pieces a jury hears, the fewer they have to assemble. But this week, the judge made it clear the jury is going to hear a lot. On April 24th, the court ruled against the defense's motion to exclude or limit a wide state of expert witnesses brought forward by the state. The argument from the defense was mostly procedural. They claimed many of the discoveries were vague. I like to look at stars. On nights where you can't see the stars. Incomplete and lacked the kind of detailed methodology required by Idaho's discovery rules. Essentially, they said the prosecution didn't fully outline how these experts reached their conclusions, so their testimony would be thrown out. Probably not a surprise to Ann Taylor, but hey, it's got to try. But the judge wasn't persuaded. The court found that any gaps or ambiguities in the expert disclosures weren't violations. They were opportunities for cross-examination. If the defense thought the conclusions were flawed, they could challenge them during trial. What they couldn't do was erase them altogether before the jury even had a chance to hear them. And with that ruling, the prosecution narrative just got sharper. You know, like the blade that Koberger bought on Amazon. First up, the state's cell phone expert, FBI Special Agent Nicholas Balance. He's part of the agency's Cellular Analysis Survey Team, or CAST for short. If you're not familiar, CAST agents specialize in mapping cell phone movements using tower pings, call detail records, and signal propagation analysis. In this case, Balance analyzed records from AT&T tied to Koberger, as well as to Madison Mogan and Zana Kernodle, two of the victims. He also conducted what's called drive testing, which essentially involves replicating signal routes in real time to eliminate phone locations at specific times. Balance's reports, which runs 30 pages, lays out when and where Koberger's phone allegedly connected to various towers. One key point in that report, just before the murders, around 2:47 a.m. on November 13th, 2022, Koberger's phone reportedly pinged a tower southeast of his Pullman apartment. Then at 2:54 a.m., the phone went dark. cutting off all connection to the network. According to Balance, that blackout window matters. It suggests intentional disabling of the phone or being in a location without service, both of which are relevant to the timeline. The defense brought in their own cell phone expert, Cy-Ray, who, by the way, on the weekends can fix that cracked screen for you for only $99. Okay, I'm making that part out. I am, unless he really does that. And which he does, well, then I'm sure he does a lovely job. To challenge Balance's findings, Ray claimed Balance's disclosures were missing key pieces, like analysis of certain handoff data or documentation for how the drive testing was performed. He also argued that the state didn't explain why certain tower coverage maps were omitted. Ray's take was that this missing data could be exculpatory, at the very least critical to assessing the reliability of Balance's conclusions. The court acknowledged the criticism, but found that Balance had disclosed enough to satisfy the legal standard. The CAST report laid out the facts, the methodology, and the conclusions, and while it may not have spelled out every microscopic step, the judge said that wasn't required under Rule 16. If Ray had an issue with the methods, he can bring that up during cross. But the jury will get to hear Balance's full testimony. Then there's the digital forensic duo, Heather and Jared Bernhardt from Cellbrite. These are the folks who looked into Koberger's phone and school-issued computer. Their conclusion? There were gaps, not just random empty spaces, but chunks of time or data simply wasn't there. Gaps in the system logs, gaps in the Chrome browser history, missing event logs during key dates like November 11th through the 16th. The Bernhardt's professional opinion? These gaps were abnormal. They suggest the possibility of data wiping, private browsing, or use of anti-forensic tools to scrub activity. The defense argued that the term abnormal was too vague, and that the state didn't properly explain what habit they were comparing Koberger's behavior to. But the court pointed out something important. Nowhere in the disclosures did the Bernhardts actually use habit analysis in the legal sense. They were simply pointing to what they observed, a break from expected system behavior. That's a technical finding, not a psychological profile. Their report backed that up with specifics. They found deleted logs, evidence of possible file cleanup, and behavior inconsistent with routine academic device usage. That's not speculation, that's just analysis. And again, if the defense thinks it's flawed, they can push back during trial. But the jury is going to hear it. Now, zooming out from the technical side, the court also approved testimony from Michael Douglas, not the actor, a forensic accountant with the FBI. Douglas reviewed Koberger's financial records, debit card usage, and ATM withdrawals, and what he found was a shift in behavior around the time of the murders. For November 10th, Koberger was using his debit card regularly. After that, it stops. Instead, he starts pulling out cash. That's interesting. Wonder why that is. Can't track cash as easily as you could a debit card or a credit card. Douglas didn't offer a psychological profile or suggest why the change happened. He just documented the shift. And the judge made it clear factual observations about spending behaviors don't need to be paired with a motive to be admissible. The data speaks for itself. The pattern, the dates, the transaction, that's all fair game to the jury. They can interpret it. And then there's Darren Gilbertson. He's the lead detective for the Idaho State Police, and he did something that the defense probably wishes he hadn't. He ran timed walkthroughs at 112 King Road, the scene of the murders. Gilbertson retraced the route a suspect would have to take to carry out the killings using different paces and paths and factoring in the estimated number of stab wounds. His conclusion? Depending on the route and speed, the entire crime could be committed by one person in approximately 2 to 4 minutes. The defense tried to block Gilbertson's testimony, saying he wasn't a qualified expert in timed runs. They also said the walkthrough was flawed because Gilbertson was familiar with the house. It had already been vacated, and importantly, the defense can't repeat the test because the house has since been torn down. But the judge disagreed. The test didn't require specialized credentials. Gilbertson is the lead investigator, and timing and route through a crime scene isn't outside the scope of law enforcement work. And while the house was later demolished, that happened after Gilbertson's walkthrough, after his report was disclosed. If the defense wanted to run their own experiment, they did have the opportunity. Finally, there's Dr. Gary Dawson. His role is a bit more surgical, no pun intended. He's a rebuttal expert brought in specifically to challenge the defense's argument that multiple attackers must have been involved. In part because Madison Mogan and Kaylee Gonzalez were reportedly in the same bed at the time of the attack. The defense's expert, Brent Turvey, suggested that Mogan would have to put up a fight and that two people would have been needed to control the scene. Dawson, however, analyzed toxicology data and concluded that Mogan was markedly intoxicated at the time of her death. His opinion is that she would not have been capable of meaningful resistance. That conclusion doesn't contradict the facts, it contextualizes them. And the court agreed that this kind of rebuttal was relevant and admissible, depending on how the defense experts present their case at trial. So what does this all mean? It means the jury won't be going into this trial with a blank canvas. They'll hear from analysts, forensic scientists, investigators, and doctors, each adding another layer to the prosecution's case. The defense tried to keep some of that out. Argued that the rules weren't followed, that the disclosures weren't specific enough, but the court made a clear distinction. Imperfect disclosure is not the same as inadmissible testimony. And you're just kind of full of shit. You can say that this is that, but it doesn't mean it's that. And what's even more telling is the pattern. The defense isn't just arguing innocence. They're trying to shrink the case, narrow the scope. Limit the exposure. But if all of that we just talked about was about the court refusing to take the death penalty off the table, what we're about to jump to do is the court refusing to take the story off the record. The jury is going to hear the full weight of the prosecution's evidence, and that includes what was found, when it was found, and who says it matters. It is easy to look back and say that someone should have done something in a moment of chaos, especially when you're holding the privilege of hindsight in one hand and a court transcript in the other. But when you're actually in it, when something is off but you can't name it, when something terrifying is happening in real time, but your brain has not caught up yet. You don't always act the way that the textbook says you will. Or what a podcaster says you will. Or what Jim Bob down the road says you will. Or what whoever says you will. Especially not the women sending in panties and letters to Koberger says you will. And that's exactly what makes the roommate message and the 911 call from the night of the University of Idaho murder so important and also so human. This past week, the court handed down a detailed ruling on what the jury will and won't hear regarding communications from the two surviving roommates, DM and BF. In the early hours of November 13th, 2022, these are the women who were inside the house at 112 King Road while four of their friends were killed just a floor above. And for months, speculation about what they saw, when they saw it, and what they did after has swirled in public forums like wildfire. In court, however, the court is, however, only interested in what's legally relevant. More importantly, what's admissible? Let's start with the messages. Between 4:22 and 4:26 a.m., DM and BF exchanged a flurry of texts that are now cleared to be shown to the jury. These weren't long, reflective texts. They were short, fragmented, and anxious. Exactly the kind of rapid, in-the-moment burst you'd expect when something's wrong, but your body hasn't processed just how wrong yet. One of the texts from DM reads, "No one is answering." And then I'm really confused, RN. Another, what's going on? And then the shift comes. She starts describing what she saw. No, it's like ski mask almost. And a bit more detailed. Like he had something over his head. And a little mouth. She follows it with, Bethany, I'm not kidding, I'm so freaked out. On the other end, BF replies, yeah, dude, WTF. Then Xana was wearing all black. And in a final desperate attempt to find safety and something that makes sense here, she urges, come to my room, run down here. These messages now fall under two legal exceptions to the hearsay rule. Present sense impression and excited unutterance. Translation? The court believes these messages were made either during or immediately after the event DM perceived and while she was still under the stress of that perception. There's no time to concoct a story here. The law recognizes that people in distress usually don't have the luxury or the motive to fabricate. They react. And that's what makes these messages legally relevant. But it's not just about proving what they said. It's about painting a picture of what that house felt like in those early morning hours. Confusion, fear, silence. DM had seen a masked figure. She didn't know what to make of it. She didn't know people were dead yet. She just knew something wasn't right. And she was scared enough to send a string of panicked texts and then ran to BF's room for safety. That isn't calm behavior. It's a kind of panic that doesn't always read as panic when you're still trying to believe that things are normal. Now, 8 hours later, around 11:56 a.m., the 911 call was made. And this call has become one of the most scrutinized pieces of the entire case. The defense wanted to suppress parts of it, of course. The prosecution wanted the whole thing in. The judge landed somewhere in the middle. The audio of the 911 call will be allowed to play for the jury. The official transcript will also be shown alongside it to help the jurors follow on what's being said. But not everything in the call gets a free pass. Some portions, especially statements that qualify as hearsay, aren't covered by exemptions. And those will be redacted unless the state lays the proper foundation in trial, and there's still plenty of time for that. So while the jury will hear the emotion, the breathing, the confusion, they won't hear statements that speculate about events unless they meet the evidentiary bar. Here's what's in the call. BF is the first voice. She's saying her voice is strained, or you can hear her voice being strained. She tells the dispatcher, something is happening. Something's happened in our house, and we don't know what, but she can't continue. The phone gets passed around to others, DM, a friend named HJ, and an unidentified female. There's heavy breathing, sobbing, fragments of panic. One voice says something about someone being passed out, and another mentions someone who was drunk last night and not waking up. Or, at that moment in time, so they thought. Then, DM takes the phone and asks, can I just tell you what happened? The dispatcher cuts her off. I need to know what's going on right now. Eventually, HJ confirms what's become clearer by the second. She's not breathing. That moment when the veil finally lifts and the realization hits that this isn't just a weird morning, that people aren't hungover or passed out or ignoring texts. It's raw. It's terrifying, and it's now part of the record. The court's decision to allow the transcript alongside the audio might seem minor, but it's a big deal in trial presentation. Jurors aren't just hearing panic, they're seeing it written out in black and white. That is weight. That sticks. But it's important to understand something here. The court isn't using this call to argue guilt or innocence. That's not the point. The call and the text exchanges are about anchoring the timeline. They help establish when things were perceived, how people reacted, and what the environment inside the house was like. It adds human texture to the forensic frame. And in a case like this, where the defendant didn't confess, where motive remains murky, and where the physical evidence is complex, that emotional layer becomes part of how jurors interpret everything else they see. And that's when things get tricky for the defense, because while these texts and this 911 call don't name Koberger, they do something arguably more powerful. They lay bare the chaos of that morning, the confusion, the missed signals, the disbelief. They show a house in emotional freefall. And even though the defense might say that none of it proves your client was there or that he did anything, I'm sorry, Ann Taylor doesn't talk that way. The Probergers do. Sorry to you guys, too. Actually, I'm really not. That's not really the issue here. The issue is what kind of credibility the jury gives to everything else once they hear those young women try to make sense of something unspeakable in real time. That credibility, how jurors perceive the surviving roommates, their trauma, their actions, and their tone, can influence how later evidence is received. Not because it's logical, but because it's human. And when someone says, "I saw a man in a ski mask," and follows it with, "I'm not kidding, I'm so freaked out," jurors tend to lean in. They don't forget that. And yet, it is just as important to note that the court didn't allow in, at least not yet, some portions of the 911 call that were deemed hearsay and will stay redacted again, unless the prosecution can show they meet legal standards for admissibility. That's the court drawing a clear line between emotion and evidence. Just because something feels important doesn't mean it clears the bar. And the judge made it clear, no shortcuts, no assumptions. If it's coming into this trial, it has to be justified, which is smart. You don't want appellate issues at the end of this. So now with these rulings, we have a fuller picture of the morning after. Not through the lens of prosecutors or defense attorneys, but from the voices inside that house. The words typed in the dark. The frantic calls for help. The long hours of not knowing. These aren't conclusions, they're context. And context in a trial this complicated is everything. The jury won't be hearing about DNA, phone pings, or timeline estimations. They'll be hearing footsteps in the hallway, the silence of unanswered texts, and a phone call laced with disbelief. And from there, they'll be asked to piece it together and to what it all means. And when exactly everything went so horribly wrong. What are your thoughts on what has been admitted and denied in this case? Tell me in the comment section. Would love to hear it. And if you disagree, that's fine. But bring your argument. Don't just, you're so lying. You're so misinformed. And then you leave it. Okay, what am I misinformed on? What are we lying about? Because, look, from this perspective, I'm not lying about anything. I don't come on here to lie. I come here to bring you pretty much the raw information, and you do with it what you will. But if you feel that something is inaccurate, tell me. And you can't just be saying, well, it's crooked cops. Okay, well, explain. Why? How? Who's crooked? Why? What are they doing? Give me some information, other than just wild accusations. We don't speak in bumper stickers here, so I encourage you to comment on YouTube, but let's make it a good conversation. If you're listening on the podcast platform, press subscribe there, please, and also do check out our YouTube channel where you can watch everything that we do and also join into that conversation. We'd love it if you did. My name's Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. There's a lot more to this case, and we will talk again soon.
Craving non-stop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7-9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.